everybody. David Hayward here. Today I'm talking with Reese Frank on Meet a Member podcast. She's a member of the Lasting Supper. Hello, Reese.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so glad we could talk today.
Thanks. Me too.
Yeah. Don't be nervous. Just relax. We're just friends here. This isn't live, so if we make any boo-boos, we can fix it and stuff. So just relax. Let's just okay. Act like we're friends, since we already are. And
okay.
And your stories and everything on the Lasting Supper, as well as your blog, are just amazing. And so I know I'm really looking forward to our conversation, and I know a lot of people are looking forward to hearing it too. So your blog today. Well, first of all, thanks so much for being on the Lasting Supper, and I just really love your input, and you really get things going, and there's a lot of, I don't know, you have an ability to create conversation and create a feeling of community. So I think that's a gift that you have. You have a gift of getting people gathering around and talking about things. So I think that's really cool, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So you grew up in the South. Let's go from the big picture to the small picture. So can you tell us where you grew up, what denomination maybe you were a part of, you were in a family, blah, blah, blah. Maybe we can get a big picture.
Where I grew up is still now even an awkward question to answer. My father was in the military, and our moves were frequent and unexpected and sometimes chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
So where I grew up, I kind of border it by the States.
Right.
I grew up in the States, as opposed to overseas or one certain region or another.
Uh-huh.
So the two probably consistent things to my growing up was first the military and then the church.
Mm-hmm.
The church we were a part of, we were never told during that time that it was really a connected denomination. We just were always at independent Baptist churches.
Okay.
They were very consistent no matter where we lived, in their teachings and their styles and the connections they had to certain men.
Okay.
So that's kind of that part.
Uh-huh.
So
you had a mom and a dad. Your mom is a woman of color.
Yes, she's Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
My dad is German.
Mm-hmm.
Straight up Hochdeutsch German.
Mm-hmm.
And I am the second of five surviving children.
Wow. Okay, that's a loaded statement. Okay, keep going.
I'm not sure where to go from there. Five kids within 6 years.
Okay.
And
you're married? You have a partner and you have children?
Yes, I do. Dave and I have been married for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
Last week.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And we have two children, an 8.5-year-old and a 4.5-year-old.
Uh-huh.
So
yep.
Those are all the children we've been able to have. So mm-hmm. that's...
And so the stories you... It sounds like you grew up in a very, very disciplinarian denomination or church and family.
I would say that the theology, the more I look at it, is not just twisted. It was one of violence.
Uh-huh.
And kind of a casual brutality.
Mm-hmm.
I know that sounds dramatic. I try really hard not to be dramatic about it, but the more I refuse to teach my own children that, and the more I even tell Dave that, and he just looks at me like I'm speaking a foreign language, I realize this is not how kids in the church should be growing up.
Why don't you tell us some stories? Like, I was reading your blog this morning. It sounds like because your mom was a woman of color that the KKK showed up at your house and burnt crosses on your front yard.
Yeah, that was a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean,
that'd be terrifying as a child.
Yeah, but I mean, to back up even farther on that, to just say that was a nightmare that I had all the time as a little girl, and even today, I'll have that nightmare. And finally, I told one of my sisters about it, and she goes, I dream about those crosses. I dream about those ghosts. And when I sketched out, and it was only a few years ago that I actually started to talk to her about this. So this would be my next sister, Lark. She's exactly a year and a week younger than me. And I sketched out this thing. And I mean, we've always known what the Klan was. We've always known, you know, the whole racist thing. We've run into that our whole lives. But as I sketch out these pictures, and she sketches out these pictures, and we have these ghosts walking around, and we look at each other and we say the same thing at the same time, which is, that's the Klan. We know where we lived at that point, which was deep, deep South Carolina. And so I started telling her about that night. Just how, I mean, my dad was gone. He was on a mission. He was gone. He'd been gone for a while. And the noise that my mom had started going to the store less and less because of the way she was being treated. She's keeping us inside more and more. Like, there is, when I look at the pieces, I'm not sure what all was going on, but by the point of this night, or suddenly I could hear all these voices outside, and she just started getting more and more scared. And she started putting us in the van as fast as she could, just throwing us in the van, just, you know, one after the other, just, don't look, keep your head down, don't look, don't look. Mm-hmm. And she was crying and trying to start the van, and I don't think I'd really ever seen her drive very much up until this point. And I remember her hair falling in front of her face, and just don't look, and she's backing out, and there's this man in red. And I don't even know what all they were saying, but I remember the fire. I remember the crosses, and I remember the screaming, and she drove away. I couldn't stop looking at the fire in our yard. We got to the church, and they wouldn't let us in.
Why?
Understanding that my dad has blue eyes, and he's white, and we already knew at that point that Jesus only loved white people. The curse of Ham and defiling and abomination, those were all words that were used easily. To be mixed was to be an abomination.
Right.
And not only had my mom married him, she'd had children. And not just one, but all, you know, at this point, four of us. So, we just knew that God loved white people.
So, you grew up in this household. From the blog, it sounds like your mom was depressed a lot, and that your father was violent a lot. Is that true?
I think so. I mean,
yeah, you're looking back and interpreting through the eyes of a child. I know that, but it seems that you suffered a lot of violence. That's for sure.
He called it discipline.
Right.
They called it grace, because to be alive was better than we ever deserved. Any sin was the result. I mean, the wages of sin is death. That was their favorite thing to say. You know, every sin you did, you know, tell me the verse about it. And you tell them these verses, and the words would make no sense to me, but I knew that it brought judgment. Right. I knew it brought this kind of regimented grace. She was just as violent, but she was unpredictable. You could go from cooking in the kitchen with her to suddenly somebody has just been slammed against the cabinet, just, and then it's stop crying, everybody, we're having fun, you know, we're going to have fun. Whereas with him, it was, you always knew you didn't measure up, and when you don't measure up, you get in trouble.
Yeah. So like with your father, you were constantly terrified, but like with your mom, the terror was never knowing when the hammer was going to fall.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, even right now, it's hard to talk about that because like I had not told. I only started telling Dave this year any of it. And realizing that, you know, hey, not everybody lives like this. Not everybody lived like this. Mm-hmm. And I'm still, part of me is terrified that my parents will somehow find this and they'll know that I told.
Right.
It's just, which is unreasonable.
Yeah. How old were you when you, left
ran?
Home? Yeah.
I was 20. But it took me 3 years to plan, to save, to sneak around, to lie, to hold my money back so that I could leave. When I was 17, I was in a courtship with somebody who was approved of by my father. Understanding that, you know, courtship in these churches is about what I understand now is the modesty culture, the purity culture. You know, fathers own their daughters. They own their daughter's body and soul. They control their body. They control the heart. They control everything of their daughters, because without that, a girl is weak and easily led and a temptation. So you have all of that. And so he gave me to this. I was 16 at the time, and this boy was 18.
Yeah.
He did that. It was not a very enjoyable relationship, but it wasn't as bad as being at home.
Right.
So I put up with it, because what else was I going to do? I didn't know any better. I mean, I'd only been going to the public school at that point for 3 years, I think.
Right.
And I did not believe a word anybody said anywhere. I didn't trust a soul. I didn't trust anybody. I went to camp the summer that I was 17 and I was a counselor. And for some reason, there were people from other churches there.
Right.
And the girls would stay up late and they would talk. And they would talk about their boyfriends. And this one girl goes, "Well, I broke up with him." And I just looked at her and I said, "Why? If you were courting, why did you break up?" She goes, "He was too pushy and he wouldn't take no for an answer." And it was this revelation.
Yeah.
You said no? And then you broke up with her? Like, you said no. I left camp. And when I got back to my parents' house, I called and I broke up with this boy. And he was livid. He called my parents. He said I was going crazy, that I needed to be committed, that I was going to say all kinds of crazy things about him, which were lies. You know, I was making stuff up. I was just horrible, and he couldn't believe my dad had ever permitted him to court me because nobody would ever take me. I mean, on and on and on. And so the next 24 hours were more of a nightmare than I'd ever experienced, with the yelling and the accusations and the screaming and the chasing through the house. I ended up with a broken arm. And when they took me in, they said, "What happened?" And I said, again, thing that I always said, I fell. And I was so ashamed at that point for lying for my parents again. And I decided that I could leave. So I started working only in approved places, but somehow, I have no idea what he was thinking, but somehow I got to be working at this company that was run by Christian men.
Right.
So they were still patriarchal, they were still all that, but they'd all gone to this college in Indiana, everybody there, and there were even some women there who had gone to college. Mm-hmm. And they talked about this place like it was freedom, and it was, you know, Virginia to Indiana. Wow, that's so far away. There's mountains between us and time zones. And
yeah,
I got my boss's help, and everybody there helped me apply to the school. So I got acceptance, and then I presented it to my parents with my boss, who was way bigger than my dad. Like, this was a big deal. He was way bigger than my dad. That was, he couldn't say no. He could not say no without looking really, really bad in front of this other huge man.
Yeah.
And I left.
Wow.
That fall was when I met Dave and some other people who were part of a community called the Soup House and Mukapa. And my parents didn't like what they were hearing, I think, in my voice, because by Christmas they called and said they would not sign my student loans. I needed to come home. They didn't approve of what I was learning, what I was doing. And I had just enough strength to say I was not going to come home. At that point, my dad said, well, if you choose not to come home now, don't bother coming home at all.
Right.
And I hung up the phone. I did not go home.
Mm-hmm.
It still took me another, wow, from that point, 16 years to really like sever and understand what I needed to sever. But still, at that point, I did not go home.
That was a huge first step.
And one of the people they disapproved of the most, you know his name. It was Dave.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think those were probably the first steps towards freedom that I really consciously chose.
Yeah. Yeah, so you grew up in this really, it sounded like a horrific childhood. And then when you were around 17, for some reason, you got it in your head that you wanted to be free. You saw another world being talked about by these girls at camp and some guys, and you got this job, and then you planned your own escape.
Yeah. It took me 3 years to save for it, but
wow,
I did.
Where did you save your money, in a bank or what?
No, I have this thing for being outside.
Yeah.
So I always had hiding places outside. I always knew where all the secret spots were. So I was actually hiding my money there because my parents still had my social security card and all my identification. So there was no way to get a bank account without them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually hiding it in a couple of different spots, and I still had to give them most of it. That's why it took me so long. I had to pay for everything. That was the way we were raised. You know, as long as you choose to live in my house, put your feet under my table, under my roof, you will abide by my rules.
Mm-hmm.
And it costs money to live here. So I was always paying them for everything. So it took me quite a while to, like, sneak out the money and to not give them everything. And I made some mistakes, too, in that I flunked a class. I was sneaking out to night school and flunked a class. So they found out about that. And that ended with...
Yeah.
That didn't go so well.
Yeah, one of the things that you were raised on was if you don't work, you don't eat. And so there was, and if you did anything wrong during the day, you didn't eat either. So there was quite a few times, it sounds like, that you missed a meal.
Yeah.
And you had to stand and watch the family eat while you didn't eat.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a class system in our house. The good enough, the not good enough, the depraved, which was me.
Yeah.
You know, the loved, the not loved. Everything had a price. I was hungry a lot. I fended for myself a lot. I learned how to... Some days I was so hungry I would snatch some oats because nobody counted those.
Yeah.
Taught myself how to fish. By the time I was 8, we moved somewhere that was really rural, and I really think it saved my life. I had stopped caring at that point. I had stopped caring. I wanted to just not exist. Everything hurt so much. I mean, the nights were horrible. The days were worse. And we moved to this place, and it was acres of open grass and a pond and trees that I could climb and raspberries and fish and turtles, and he never bothered to go more than 100 yards out of the house.
Right.
He didn't either. It saved my life.
So you became a little hunter-gatherer.
Yeah. Yeah. I did.
So that's yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Little Hunter. How are your children?
Meaning how are, I don't understand what you're asking.
Well, how are they? Are they good?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They are unafraid.
Mm-hmm.
They are loved.
Yeah.
Secure.
Yeah. Dave sounds like a great guy.
Yeah.
The way you talk about him.
Yeah, he is. He grew up in a completely different theological background.
Right.
Taken even until this year, I think, as just trying to tell him bits and pieces and be like, that doesn't make any sense. And now I can show him articles, you know, hey, people actually say this stuff. They really do get taught this. And he just goes, that's horrible. That's barbaric. That's...
Yeah.
It just is foreign to him.
Yeah. Well, it's like you say, it's in the news now when, you know, children are escaping from cults or from their parents. Even, who's that preacher down there, the God Hates Fags guy? Hillsboro Baptist.
Yeah, Westboro.
Westboro Baptist, yeah.
That...
His kids have escaped.
Yeah, he's kind of tame.
Yeah.
To be quite honest, he's kind of tame. The other thing that helps is this year, again, I was reading something that someone else had been writing. I started filling in the gaps of what she was saying. I started knowing her words before I read them, before she would finish.
Mm-hmm.
And then she names Independent Fundamentalist Baptist Church, and she calls it a cult.
Yeah.
I look it up. I look up the churches we went to. I look up the preachers and the schools and the... And there's direct lines of contact. There's direct lines of connection. It didn't matter where we lived. These churches all followed the same leadership, First Baptist Church of Hammond. Jack Hiles, Hiles Anderson, Bob Jones University, all
right.
of it. And it was like a light. And I emailed my next sister, Lark, and I'm like, this was real. Because up to this point, we felt crazy. Because you're moving in the middle of the night. You're going to these churches that sound eerily the same, yet they are supposedly different.
Mm-hmm.
And how can somebody teach so much the same thing and be in a different place? Like, it has to be made up. Who goes to these churches? But it was real, and people are calling it out.
Mm-hmm.
And even as I talk to her, we're not surprised by the things that are being said of some of these churches.
Mm-hmm.
So
you made contact? You formed a relationship with this person you read?
No.
Oh.
No, she disappeared.
Oh.
She disappeared. What happens is I think people start talking against the IFB and the harassment that comes back, they start to shut down. Her blog is locked up now because I think she got harassed enough.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Reese, the risk that you took leaving home, and you know, as a result, you enjoy some freedom and things like that. But, you know, you're an adult now, but you know there are still ramifications to what you've done. I mean, it's not like you left home and then they cut all ties. They still try to ruin your life.
Yeah, they do.
It's not over until what? You know what I mean? Yeah.
Which sounds really cold. I mean, even the fact that I'm writing under a pseudonym right now is because I am terrified that they will find out I'm telling and take action. I don't even know how to get to the point of being strong enough to say under my own name, I know this person by name and I know what they did. But right now, it's as much as I can do is to walk right up to the edge and say, I remember this.
Mm-hmm.
Good at that, but I'm trying. I'm trying because I know there are people who are still trapped in there or who have left and are still trapped in the nightmare and they think it wasn't real or it wasn't that bad or they're crazy or they deserved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fighting those same demons, and if I write,
yeah,
maybe give somebody else a voice.
So when somebody leaves, that takes a huge heroic step, in my opinion, a lot of courage to leave. And then you have to deal with, them continually harassing you, not just your parents, but their friends and the church. And if they find out that their church is being talked about online, they'll take action and, all this kind of thing. But there's also the your own emotional, spiritual, psychological healing, right?
Yes. Yes.
So that's another issue altogether. It's not just external warfare. It's like an inner battle as well.
Very much. And I think the inner battle instructs the outer battle. The things that I shied away from, the things that I ran from that I couldn't explain, were very much expressions of an internal battle where I was afraid to even turn around and look and to say, even to Dave, this happened, like to say it. Mm-hmm. Every time I do, it's exercising a demon, but it's also a terrifying step of, if I tell you this thing, there's still the, you will know what a horrible sinner I am, how shameful this is, you will know. Mm-hmm. Every time I tell.
So when you write a story, what do you feel when you write a story? Do you feel embarrassed? Or what are you feeling when you write? Because when you click post or publish, you're taking a risk every time you do that. Not just with fears of your parents finding out or whatever, but you're laying yourself out there. You're sort of making yourself very vulnerable. So how do you feel when you click that publish button?
So that's a funny question for me too, just because I'm on the autism spectrum, and so people say, "How do you feel?" And I go, "I don't understand what you mean," because it's a bunch.
That's fair. That's fair. What goes through your mind when you're clicking the publish button?
First, when I start to write, I'm writing something I remember, mm-hmm. which means I'm living it. If I were to say in words out loud, most of the time, a story that I've written, unless I've written it, it's even more spare. It is, I was here, I was standing there, the belt looks like this, he said this, mm-hmm. the end. Mm-hmm. When I write, I'm living. I am that size again, and it is replaying, because that's what PTSD does, is you are constantly living the nightmares.
Well, I just want to interject, like reading your stories, it's... I'm telling you, it's bone chilling. Like, I'm not a fan of horror movies. Like, I don't like watching horror movies or Stephen King or anything. Yeah. But I've read some Stephen King. And I'm telling you, when I'm reading your stories, there's no capitals. You use periods and commas, but there's no capital letters. And you're talking like a child. Like, you're writing as if you're that age. You're writing as if it's happening right now. I'm telling you, it is bone chilling. It's terrifying, because even when nothing's happening, there's that absolute terror that something's going to happen any second. And you really do capture that suspense.
I feel like saying I'm sorry, because it's not my intent to terrify anybody. It's just, this is what happened.
Yep.
I try to be really careful.
I know.
Okay.
I know you're not trying to terrify people. I know you're not trying to create effect or anything like that. You're just telling your story. But I'm just telling you, like, it pulls me in. It just has a way of pulling me in and actually feeling like I'm right there and that I'm that person.
I think what goes through my mind is, like, even when I'm telling it, most of these stories, and not to be, I'm not sure what the right word is, but I'm still just walking right up to the edge. I'm walking right up to the edge, and then there's a point where there aren't any more words for what happened, but I'm trying to, I feel kind of defiant. Like, I'm naming the demons, I'm naming the dark, and I'm shoving it out, just purging it out, just pushing it outside of me that, fine, here, this happened. This was real. And for every story I ever even publish, there's at least 10 more that I started or started and finished that I can't even bear to show, because it exposes so much. I mean,
I
feel now what I didn't feel as much then in my skin, in my soul. I feel it, and I feel defiant.
Well, you know, when you're telling your stories as a child, you were defiant even then. I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean that you just had a very strong personality back then. You recognize that, right? That probably is part of the reason you got in trouble.
Okay. Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but part of me just wants to go, I didn't mean to be.
No, I know.
It's just like, it's so strange, I think. No, just to hear the same word from you, but it's meant with love.
Yeah, it is meant
with love. Or it was a judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a bringing down of complete wrath. Mm-hmm. To the point, you know, because I asked Lark, I mean, we talk a lot, and River too, like, we're the three that have pulled. And they said, you were the truth teller. Like, you just could not let go. Like, if somebody said, the simplest thing, if you say 3 and 3 is 7, and I would just say, no, it's not. Not because I have to be right, but because it's not. The world is the way it is. Don't mess with it. And I see it in our kids. You know, I mean, she'll insist that she'll insist that these are not shoes. They are sandals. Mm-hmm. And in the world I grew up in, that's defiance. That's talking back. That's sin. That needs to be broken. Mm-hmm. You know, or she doesn't want me to trim her nails because it's her body. You know what? I can wait.
Yeah.
There's no reason to intrude on her sense of herself just to be big and just to be right and just to be God. Mostly I felt really weak, and broken.
Mm-hmm. Well, my God, you're definitely a survivor. I mean, I think you're just amazing. But how have you done it? Like, what have you done? You know, you've left home, you worked, you saved money, you went to school. You found, you know, you and David found each other. You've had kids. How have you, you know, I don't know how to say this. How have you healed yourself?
Wow. Honestly, I don't feel healed. I kept running until last year. Mm-hmm. Like, I never told Dave. I never told anybody. I learned to ignore my nightmares. I learned to ignore my flinching. I learned to just never tell.
Right.
Bits and pieces healed, because obviously the longer I knew Dave, I managed to trust him enough to date and then marry when I was never ever going to give ownership of myself to another man again, ever allow that.
Right.
Then our daughter was born. And by that point I'd had our son. And by that point, I believe I'd had probably 5 or 6 miscarriages. We'd given up on having any more living children. Mm-hmm. And she was born. She almost died the day she was born. And she continued to struggle for almost 10 weeks, 68 days. And people started offering these platitudes, and my parents showed up and tried to take her. They wanted the right to make decisions, and I refused. They were very angry about that. Bits and pieces, as she grew, she would struggle here, be okay, struggle, be okay. Like, it was just, I'm kind of glossing over a lot, I know. But the answers from the faith community we were part of just dissatisfied me more and more. And last year, something happened that really threatened the fabric of our family. From the outside, and we continue to fight that, but as that happened, my world imploded. Every scar I had ripped wide open. And at that point, I had to face the fact that my secrets in the middle of this fight would kill us. I had to trust Dave, because he kept saying, just tell me, tell somebody, just talk. And finally, once I admitted, I said, this is a scar. He said, what happened? And I said, the belt. And that was all I could do at that point. But it was enough to start. And the more I tell him, yeah, this is a scar, or he'd say, you flinch like somebody taught you how to duck who hit you. And I'd be like, nobody hit me. I'm fine. Nobody ever hit me. And I finally told him, and he just said, I know. I've probably known since I met you, and it's been 17 years. But this year, through counseling, through trusting him, through talking to him, even though our world is still on the verge of implosion all the time, I can sit next to him with him on the right, and he'll move, and I don't always flinch. This is huge.
Wow.
And I'm also taking a medicine that they give to veterans. It was an accidental discovery that they had that this blood pressure medicine reduces and blocks night terrors and the hypervigilance that comes with PTSD. So I don't flinch as much at all. I can be hugged now. I can sit next to somebody without being constantly aware that they're there. And that feels really good.
Wow.
It feels really good.
So it sounds like you've had the encouragement, the comfort of your husband. It sounds like your kids bring you a lot of joy. You've taken some medication, and you also mentioned some counseling. These are some steps that you've taken to aid you in your recovery, healing?
At first I was doing it because I just knew I needed somewhere to talk. I didn't trust anybody when I even first started counseling to even tell.
Right.
So it's been a process of learning to trust myself, to trust that I, like, okay, here's a novel idea. I was born good.
Yeah.
That I say that and it just completely flips my world upside down every time. I'm like, no, I was born good. Holy, whatever. I don't even know how to, it's a complete paradigm shift.
Yeah.
It's a polarity change. It is taking something that was irrational in the number world and making it a rational number. I mean, you use pi, an irrational number, to describe a circle, to describe a sphere. Irrational numbers to describe actual real things. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of, sorry, I like numbers.
I'm gathering that.
I kind of have this obsession with numbers and prime numbers. And anyway.
Is that something to do with the autism spectrum?
Yeah, it is. I'm on the autism spectrum, and I have a thing for powers and numbers and bending them and shifting them, and don't get me started.
So all these irrationalities in your life are working together to make a perfect circle.
I think
a sphere.
A sphere that I hold the center of, that I can allow access. I can say no. I can know myself enough to find the healing I need, which brought me to the Lasting Supper, actually.
You were scared to join.
Oh, God, I was terrified.
Yeah.
How did you even... Did I tell you that? I don't even remember having this conversation, but yes, I was terrified to join.
Yeah, you were terrified. Well, I think Stephanie Drury introduced us.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah,
then we started talking on Facebook, and then I just said, you know what, just try it, just lurk around, and if you don't like it, you can leave. There's nothing's cast in concrete or whatever. And But it ended up you found it to be a safe place. And
last year, when everything started with our family, we were instantaneously cut off from a literally international network of friends and family of friends. I lost my voice, I lost my writing, I lost my connection to who I had been. So the idea that, one, and I started questioning God very, very hard. And when I started out at that layer, we had some friends here in Seattle, and I would throw myself so hard into these questions, and Jeff always met me every time. And then he said, you should meet Stephanie Drake. And I did. And they facilitated that, him and his wife, to a point that I could ask some questions, and she was filling in the gaps too. She met that, and like, we ended up talking, and just, there's something healing when you talk to Stephanie. There just is. And she introduced me to Pam, who told me too about the Lasting Supper, and it took me months to muster up the nerve to talk to you, to try to join to anything. And to be able to say and ask and defy all of these ideas that I was raised with without the fear of shunning is immense, because shunning is the powerful tool of the IFB.
It's a powerful tool, not just of that church, but many, many churches. They don't call it that. It's not official, but I mean, I've experienced that myself when I left the church 3.5 years ago. It was sort of broadcast that, you know, it's best if you didn't, you know, post David's stuff on your Facebook and things like that. And so it wasn't called shunning, but that's what it felt like.
It was very much, I was 12 when I was first officially shunned. The entire church community stopped talking to me. My parents stopped really communicating with me. It was done with their blessing, everybody's blessing. I stopped existing. I was accused of being homosexual, which I didn't even know. I didn't even know what that was.
Why would they accuse you of that?
I've picked at that for years. Like, did I hold hands with my sister too much? Did I... You know, it's just like asking, why was my dad paying attention to me like that? Why was he passing me around? Did I do something? Because, you know what? Somebody could. Somebody had the power to do something, and they knew my parents would not protect me. So they did. After about 6 months of shunning, they decided to have a biblical reconciliation. So I met with the kids who leveled the accusations. There were adults in the room, and they would just say, you did this, you did that. And if I apologized enough, if I confessed, if I repented enough, then I would stop being shunned. And I believed them, but then they would say these ridiculous things, and I couldn't help it. I'd say, no, I didn't. I didn't do that. I never did. And they'd say, stop lying. And if I still didn't, then I would be sent outside for discipline. Which really wasn't that much fun either. That sounds really dumb when I say it like that. I don't know how to explain what happened. But eventually, I apologized. Eventually, I confessed to anything they wanted. I apologized for everything they ever said. I apologized.
Why? That was just the easy way out? Just to get it to stop?
Everybody likes the myth of strength, that no matter what is done to you, you will never give in. I'm not strong like that. I am the first to admit it. I am a coward. I eventually choose to give in, because there's only so much your mind can take when your body hurts that much.
Well, I don't know if I would call you a coward. Like, it's like torture. I mean, I've read books on, you know, Abu Ghraib and places like that, and everybody knows the body can only take so much torture is effective. It does work. Everybody talks. Everybody.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just because you talk doesn't mean you're a coward. It just means you're human.
Yeah. It was just always proof, you know. See, I knew you would confess, and then it's, you didn't confess enough. Your apology isn't good enough. You don't really mean it. You're only saying it because we hurt you. Mm-hmm. You know, you're only saying it because, I mean, there's constantly the doubt, you know, wait, first confess and we will forgive you. God will forgive you, you know, just confess. But then you confess and, well, surely there's more to it, and you can't possibly just be confessing out of the goodness of your heart. You are only doing it because you've been caught. That's not a true confession. That's not a true repentance. So there's this twisting payment.
Yeah.
You're just constantly transacting through pain and shame, trying to buy your freedom.
Yeah.
It doesn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a year of hell.
Mm-hmm. I imagine. It sounded like you had a lot of years of hell, though. Really?
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate.
You know what I get from, you know, when I read your stories, and man, I really do, if you published a book, I'd be one of the first buyers. I'm serious. It's just so powerful, your writing. But one of the interesting things about your stories is it really does capture that naivete of childhood, of children who, no matter how bad things are, no matter how horrifying things get, no matter how brutal and violent their upbringing is, they just somehow mentally do these magical tricks to turn it around, to say, like, this is normal, and you know, life is good, or you know you have that weird way of capturing that naivete of kids, you know, that it somehow, this is normal. Do you know what I mean?
I think so. I mean,
because it's not normal, but the way you describe it, it's horrifying. But you have this, you communicate this child's fantasy that everything's okay somehow, in a weird way.
Well, it was. I mean, there was, we were constantly told everything was okay. This is the way the world works. There was no comparison. But by the same token, I learned to do, I think, two things that probably saved me. Mm-hmm. And one of them was, we were required to count our punishment. And if you cried, your voice wobbled, if you screamed, if you were too loud, if you forgot, you know, you start over. So over and over and over, you're counting. And I already liked numbers very, very much. They were so solid, so real. You know, you can't mess with numbers. But there was a point where I learned to pull just hard enough at the fabric of the world to find numbers. And so not only was I counting for him, but I started counting for myself. And it was counting by squares and counting by powers of two or powers of five or powers of seven. You know, I mean, just how many powers can I hold all at once to make this stop? And there comes a point where you can just, all you have are the sheer elegance of these numbers that are a constellation. It was so disappointing the first time somebody showed me numbers on paper. I mean, they were flat. They were boring. Numbers. The other thing was just discovering the outdoors, the sheer freedom and silence that was out there, the magic in the way the trees just touched the sky.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of saved me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
well, how do you feel you're doing?
I'm better than I was a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
I sleep sometimes 4 hours in a row, sometimes even without a nightmare. And you have no idea what it means to say that. I used to sleep about an hour and wake up just constantly riding the edge of flashbacks, and I can handle being touched more and casually.
Yeah.
But I hurt like I never knew was possible. I am learning all of the pain that I ignored. I am learning that it's there.
Yeah.
But there comes this rare beauty to the world when I say, yeah, that's a scar. And I'm still standing.
Yep.
I'm still standing.
Mm-hmm.
I have a long way to go. But I know what I want, and that's something. Hold on one second. Can you edit this part?
Yep.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay. We're almost done.
Okay. I forgot your question. Was I telling you something?
No, you were just talking poetically. You were saying that you've come a long way, but you're not done. You've got a ways to go.
I know what I want.
And you know what you want.
I want to tell.
Yeah.
I want to tell until there's nothing left to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even name names, write a book.
Mm-hmm. Just,
I want to tell so that nobody else can say, oh, that. What happens at home happens at home. You know, it's not the church's responsibility or just, oh, that was just one church. I'm here to tell you, I've gone to at least, by the time I was 12, I had attended at least 12 churches in 12 different locations that preached the same brutality.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised.
Yeah. So, no, it's not uncommon. It should be, and it should be exposed.
Yeah. Well, I, for one, I'm looking forward to that book. Hey, Reese, is there anything you wanted to say to people at the Lasting Supper that you didn't get a chance to say? Or anything you'd like to say?
Thank you for holding my story and just letting me be a part of the community, because it has meant a lot. Mm-hmm. And I hope to give back a measure, at least, of what has been given to me.
Oh, you are. You already are. Big time.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, it's great. Hey, just one question. Where did you learn to write? How did you learn to write? Just, are you self-taught, or did you take courses in university, or what?
You know, I never took a writing class. That's my secret, is I think I sat down at a computer. Well, I program. I'm an engineer.
Uh-huh.
So there's like that side, and then I write on the side. And, you know, even when I met Dave, I was already writing like this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's easier for me to write most of the time than to talk.
So you're a programmer and you love numbers.
Yeah, I'm a geek.
Okay, one last question.
Okay.
What's your favorite number?
Are we talking just plain numbers or prime numbers?
You name it. I don't care.
2 and 3 are actually my very favorite numbers because of everything you can do with them.
Okay.
If you start with those and I make these trees with it, I can end up out in the thousands just by shifting and bending them. I also like 437. It's a really nice number.
Awesome. Thanks, Reese. Thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.
Well, everyone, that was Reese Frank. What a fascinating story. And like all of you guys on The Lasting Supper, just an amazing person. And I am so looking forward to her book. You should check out her writing. It is really gripping. I recommend it to you. Thanks so much, Reese. Everybody loves you, and we love everybody, and we'll see everybody back on The Lasting Supper. Take care, guys. Have a great day.